Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, November 17, 2021. Some lawmakers in South Sudan say they face challenges summoning ministers.
We should have been actually conducting our normal sittings within this building, but because of the renovation which is ongoing, at the moment we're conducting sittings at the Freedom Hall.
And journalists in Sudan say press freedom is under attack by the military.
He says many journalists who are working for international media agencies and channels have been continuously receiving threatening phone calls.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A group of Sudanese journalists are calling on authorities in Sudan to respect the press freedom enshrined in the constitutional document and grant them access to information. The journalists say for nearly a month now, they have documented excessive force used against journalists and media houses, including detention and harassment. They call for an immediate release of their colleagues who are still in custody.
Journalists in Khartoum organized a silent and peaceful protest on Tuesday to demand that authorities respect press freedom. They had banners with the slogans such as "We need free press" and "Free detained journalists." Amru Shaban, the Secretary General of the Sudanese Journalist Network, says the military is still holding six journalists in detention. Among them is Maher Aboudjour, the Editor-in-Chief of the state-owned TV and radio network, who has been detained since late October. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus, Shaban says his office has documented more than 10 harassment incidents, including threatening phone calls to some journalists who are working for international media since the military coup on October 25th. He says such actions violate the press freedom enshrined in the constitution and put journalists at risk. He says many journalists who are working for international media agencies and channels have been continuously receiving threatening phone calls. Authorities have also intentionally cut off internet services from journalists as part of the systematic crackdown on journalists who are supposed to document the ongoing crimes against Sudanese people. Last Saturday, the bureau chief of Al Jazeera Network in Khartoum was arrested. Security forces released him Tuesday without charge. Sudanese security also stormed the building of the Democratic, an Arabic-speaking newspaper, and confiscated copies of the printed paper. Shaban says the use of excessive force on journalists and media houses endangers press freedom in the country. Shaban says there have been continuous atrocities committed on our people on the streets, peaceful protests and marches. He says the security has been using excessive force everywhere, including houses. The intention of the military is to cripple the media in the country and to prevent journalists from documenting crimes that are committed against the citizens. Sudanese journalist Mohammed Said condemned the use of force, saying an attack on journalists is an attack on press freedom and it violates their human rights. Speaking in Arabic, Said says he remains concerned that the internet remains cut off nearly a month after the military suspended the joint civilian-military transitional government. He says the lack of internet services has affected his work in providing information to many Sudanese citizens during this crucial time. Said says, I consider this a crime against the press and against journalists, and it shows that the new system does not value the press. The internet is one of the basic rights for access to information. It became our pen for writing, and the government is now attacking this pen. A Sudanese court ruled last week that telecommunication companies must restore internet service immediately. However, the service remains shut down. Hiba Ali, a reporter working for a Sudani Arabic daily newspaper, says for the past month they have been unable to print because of the internet shutdown. She says it is now unsafe for her and many other female journalists to go out to cover events because they fear being harassed or detained by security. Hiba says it has become clear after the military takeover that press freedom and journalists have been a target. It is the same attack that has been pursuing political activists and anybody that calls for freedoms and supports democratic transformation in Sudan. Sudanese journalists appealed to Sudanese authorities to release all their colleagues and open up more freedom for them to operate. Sudan's constitutional document enshrined the right to access to the internet to every Sudanese citizen. For Michael Atit in Khartoum, this is Nabil Biagio.
Some South Sudanese lawmakers say they face challenges while carrying out their mandate. The lawmakers say there is a lack of space for members of parliament to conduct sessions, and many ministers do not respect summons to appear at committee hearings. The designated spokesperson of the South Sudan Parliament, Yohane Bonju, says during the 100 days following the inauguration of the parliament, lawmakers have registered some achievements, including amending the conduct of business regulations and appointing chief whips. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
More than 100 days since the parties to South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement reconstituted, the National Legislative Assembly lawmakers still lack space to sit and deliberate. Paul Yuani Bonju, the designated spokesperson of the National Legislative Assembly, told the South Sudan in Focus the problem is the continuing renovation work on the parliamentary building.
We should have been actually conducting our normal sittings within this building, but because of the renovation, which is ongoing, at the moment we're conducting sittings at the Freedom Hall. This is one of the challenges, but I believe that seeing now the speed of the work, I believe within 3 to 4 months, if the necessary resources are injected to the contractor, once the chamber is done, then the normal sittings of this house will be conducted within the parliamentary precincts.
Bonju says members of the executive who defy calls and summonses to appear before lawmakers also make it difficult for legislators to hold the government officials accountable.
The second challenge is connected to some of our colleagues in the executive wing of the government. Sometimes summons reach their offices, their ministries, but you find that sometimes turn up is not to our expectation, because as a minister, if you hear that you are summoned to the parliament, then I think you are supposed to exert your utmost best to ensure that you come and update the house on the request which is presented to you.
Bonju says at least 6 ministers were summoned to appear before parliament 3 weeks ago, but none of them turned up. He says that includes Humanitarian Affairs Minister Peter Mayen and Health Minister Elizabeth Achueyol, who did not honor request to appear before Parliament to answer questions on the government's response to flooding in Unity, Upper Nile and Jonglei states. Bonju says although the House still hopes to hear from the ministers, their failure to appear at the required time is a setback to Parliament's efforts to deliver services to the citizens. Despite the problems they face, Bonju says lawmakers have registered several achievements in the first 100 days since the National Legislative Assembly was inaugurated.
The biggest achievement of this parliament is the cordial relations, the calm mood exhibited by the honorable members. We also have, when this parliament was reconstituted, when this parliament was revitalized, many people thought maybe the members, the house is going to be marred with disagreements, the house is going to be marred with quarrels, the house is going to be marred by the members attacking themselves.
Bonju says the lawmakers managed to expand the number of specialized parliamentary committees to 35 from the earlier 25. However, legislators have yet to nominate committee chairpersons. He says lawmakers also chose 2 chief whips for the ruling party and opposition. However, Boboya James, a policy analyst who heads the Juba-based Institute for Social Policy and Research, says lawmakers have achieved too little.
The parliamentarians have spent a lot of time on petty things other than strategic issues that could steer and move the National Assembly to a direction where it can be reckoned with when it comes to issues of oversight and asking the members of the executive to be able to provide the much needed services to South Sudanese, and also, you know, providing the required, you know, governance related issues in this country.
James says Parliament must perform its duties as expected.
We have seen evidence that over 50% of the members of parliament are not able to turn up because most of them are either sick, either they don't have money to, you know, to facilitate their going to parliament and things like that. So the parliament has at most functioning 50% low. And I think that has also an impact in terms of how this parliament is supposed to continue to contribute to key legislative issues.
The lawmakers were sworn into office on August 2nd. Some of the key legislations the parliament was supposed to work on in this session include amending the acts governing the National Army, the Security Service, the Police Force, the Prison Service, and Fire Brigades. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some school administrators in South Sudan say there is significant increase in the enrollment of girls in schools in the recent years due to a cash transfer program, which gives money to girls to meet their expenses and stay in schools across the country. Bernard Lado, headmaster of Gumbo Basic Primary School, says previously only three girls could be in a class of 50 learners, who are mostly boys, but that has changed. He says the number of girls is nearly equal to boys in classes. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
14-year-old Ajok Deng sits in the front row in class 7 at Gumbo Primary School in Juba. She's one of the 295,000 South Sudanese girls who receive money from the cash transfers program run by Girls Education South Sudan, or JES. Ajok says she is able to continue to attend school because of the cash transfers.
This money helps me actually. If I want to pay my school fees, I can take from this money and pay my school fees. If I'm in need of something, I can take even from this money and pay for, can buy pants and always like that. If this money continues, I will continue with my education too, because I want to be a successful girl in future. I want to be a doctor and help those who are poor.
17-year-old Rejoice Emoli, who is in primary 8 in this school, says she has been receiving cash transfers since she was in primary 5. She says without the cash transfer, she would be married a long time ago.
I would think like to stay at home because there is no shoes even to come with it in school and clothes, uniform. I don't have to help myself. I would think to stay at home. I will think like to go marriage, because if there is no dad, no one will help me, and I cannot be able to do anything even. I will think to go marriage so that my husband will help me.
Cash transfers program gives money to girls from primary 5 to senior 4 across the country to help increase the number of girls in school. Bennett Lado, headmaster of Gumbo Primary School, says before the cash transfers program, the number of girls in his school was very low.
The girls were dropping from P5 to P8, but as soon as they hear that there's money now, the girls are now increasing in class. So P8, P5 up to P8, the number is increasing. In the former time, they are dropping even up to, sometimes you get 2, but now the number is in P5 is 24, of numbers P6 is 26, and P7 is 22, and then of P8 is 25. Boys are now 368 and girls is 269. In fact, it encourages us to teach.
Julia Pony's two daughters benefited from the cash transfers program. She says before this support, she struggled to pay for her children's basic needs and education.
They need soaps, they need shoes, they need socks, and they need all scholastic materials like school bags and books. When this money came, we were relieved. We only use the little money we get to pay for the boys who don't get this money.
South Sudan education officials say there are several barriers that prevent girls from going to school. Jess research indicates that finance was the main obstacle. Daniel Geseka works for the cash transfer department at Girls Education South Sudan. He says each girl from primary 5 to secondary school received 5,600 South Sudanese pounds, which is equal to about $14 yearly. Girls in candidate classes primary 8 and senior 4 received 8,400 South Sudanese pounds, or about $21. The girls used the money to buy sanitary towels and other personal goods that enabled them to attend school regularly. Geseka says the enrollment rate of girls before the car transfers program was very low.
Today, David, as we speak, actually, they talk about 48.8% are girls. If you go into specifics, for instance, at the first year of the program, we couldn't get 2,000 girls in three states, what we call the Greater Upper Nile States, the Upper Nile, the Unity, and the Jonglei. We had less than 2,000 in total. Today, those areas we have girls, the number of girls has improved.
He says the enrollment rate for girls in the Greater Upper Nile region has increased to 98% because of the cash transfers program. The United States Agency for International Development recently announced that it is joining the United Kingdom and Canada in funding the second phase of the JES program. The second phase aims to reach over 900,000 girls in the country. Geseka says the program also supports behavioral change through a radio program to sustain the effort to keep girls in school after the cash transfers.
We also try to address the behavior and social norms, cultural social norms, of in terms of why are girls not going to school, and that is being done by our program of behavior change, where we do the radio program and the community engagement where we are speaking so that all of us appreciate. So once they come to school and they start seeing the benefits of learning, it's easier that they can be kept there.
The USAID contribution to the program aims to support non-government schools in 13 counties, including Kapoita North, Budi, and Pibor, where girls' enrollment in schools are relatively very low. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a closer look at the visit of the U.S. Secretary of State to Africa. That story is lined up after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs held a joint press conference today in Nairobi after Blinken held talks with President Uhuru Kenyatta on regional security, energy, and economic recovery. The top U.S. diplomat is visiting three African nations, including Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. For VOA News, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Visiting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta in Nairobi on Wednesday to discuss climate change, trade, the COVID-19 pandemic, and most urgently, regional security. At a news conference in Nairobi, Blinken said he and Kenyatta discussed the crisis in Ethiopia and the African effort to resolve it, led by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo.
Special Envoy Jeff Feltman is working with High Representative Obasanjo to press the parties to end hostilities immediately and without preconditions, to stop human rights abuses and violations, to provide humanitarian access for the millions in northern Ethiopia who are in dire need of life-saving supplies.
The Ethiopian government has been at war with the northern Tigray region for a year, and both sides are accused of committing widespread abuses against the population. Concern about the situation has grown in recent weeks as Tigrayan and allied forces threaten to march on the capital. On Sunday, Kenyatta visited Ethiopia, hoping to bridge the gap between the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government and Tigray regional leaders. Kenya's Foreign Minister Rachel Omamo said it is possible to find a solution to the crisis and said Ethiopians need to work hard on a peaceful resolution to the war.
We believe in the potential of Ethiopia to find a resolution to this crisis. We believe that a ceasefire is possible. We believe that the other conditions regarding humanitarian access are possible. We must believe in the fortitude and the wisdom of the Ethiopian people, because in the end, these solutions will come from them. What we must do as neighbors is to support.
Meanwhile, Blinken also touted U.S. help to Africa in battling the COVID-19 pandemic.
We've provided more than 50 million doses to 43 African countries to date, including indeed close to 4 million doses here in Kenya. We've also given more than $1.9 billion in COVID-related assistance across Africa to help meet health and humanitarian needs, including $76 million to Kenya. And we've done this with no political strings attached. This is about saving lives. That is the only metric that matters.
Secretary Blinken next travels to Nigeria and followed by a visit to Senegal. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Still on Africa, with the earth becoming warmer and weather events more extreme, the African Union has set up a disaster operation center in Nairobi to help monitor major hazards and provide regional early warnings. For drought, floods, extreme rainfall, food insecurity, and pests like the desert locust. For VOA News, Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Major hazards have become more common in Africa and show how vulnerable the continent is to climate change, even though it is the lowest producer of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. To cope with such disasters, the Africa Union has set up a centralized monitoring and early warning system for the continent. The Nairobi Disaster Operations Center for the East African Region is the continent's first weather situation room. Julie Ouma is a geographic information system analyst at the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, in Nairobi.
Council of the ministers with the member states sat and said we need to have a disaster operation center based in Nairobi, which will focus mainly on early warning systems. So that gave birth to establishment in this office, so that we look at a broader aspect of different disasters within the region.
The center, located at the IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center, uses the East Africa Hazards Watch, a system developed by the center for collecting and sharing multi-hazard data with member countries, as Ouma explains.
The system works automatically so that it ingests in the data set. Algorithm is set within the cluster. We have a supercomputing system within ICPAC. So there's less human attachment to it. It's also near real time, so it's every 10 days it updates itself and we see the conditions of drought.
The center provides climate information and early warnings to 11 East African countries. Officials say local communities must be ready to respond quickly to save lives and minimize damage. Amjad Abashar is the regional director for Africa at the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction.
So we must equip the communities themselves to be able to respond to a disaster in its first hours at least. And so I think we owe it to them to set up this early warning system and ensure that it's functional that people who are vulnerable to disasters are able to access that information in a timely way to save lives and property.
The Situation Room in Nairobi covers and reports on drought and floods. Another one in Niger, set to be opened this month, will monitor extreme rains and cyclones. The information collected at both sites will be collected and distributed by the Situation Room at the AU headquarters in Addis Ababa. Gatkuoth Kai is the technical coordinator for disaster risk reduction at the Africa Union Commission.
We are responding to a very complex situation. Over the years, we have seen disasters increasingly becoming borderless. But even when that hazard is localized, the intensity easily overwhelmed national response. And in this situation, the Pan-African solidarity is required. And therefore, having this situation room is going to facilitate that African solidarity.
As Africa experiences more extreme weather, officials say early warnings and early action will help limit its impact. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with Lucky Dube with the song Remember Me. Listening to Lucky Dube and the song Remember Me. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for joining us this evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.